Odin, that means frenzy. Odin, that means death.
The berserks howled and smashed their heads into their oars, spat and swore as they powered the boat towards the shore. The warband leader beat the rail of the ship with his rattle, screaming and shrieking out his words.
Odin's men, he shouted. We are men of Odin,
the berserks screamed back at him.
Men of Odin! We are Odin's men!
The chanting seemed to go on forever, and the berserks seemed to have an endless supply of words spilling out in chants as fast as a fighter's heartbeat. They went wild, punching at the oars as they rowed, slapping themselves and screaming the words into each other's faces. The beat became faster.
Odin! Shouted the leader, hammering his rattle into the rail. Man maddener, all hater, war screamer! Odin! Wolf fighter, spear shaker, corpse maker! Odin! Great wrecker, down thrower, foe slayer! Odin! Berserker, berserker, berserker!
Now some of the men stood, punching their chests and arms. The ship lurched as one man in his frenzy forgot his oar and the blade caught in the water.
Odin! Berserker, berserker, berserker! So they call me!
Shouted the man with the rattle.
Odin!
Howled the oarsman.
So they call me! Odin!
In his fear and excitement, the words came to Vali as impressions. They seemed more than names. It was as if the wild chanting gave them a life, as if he could see the images they conjured. Odin fighting the Fenris wolf, a spear flying through a clear blue sky, gallows and slaughter, fire and blood. The beat of the oars never slackened, though Vali was sure the men could not sustain the pace for much longer. Instead, they got faster, hardly missing a stroke, despite many of them swigging from drinking horns which were regularly refilled from a huge jug carried by a boy. Vali wondered that anyone could even lift such a pitcher, never mind pour it without spilling it on a longship as it crashed through the surf. As the jug passed, Bragi shouted across to him, though panting with exertion,
I'd have a drink if I were you. Ale waters the courage inside you and makes it grow.
Vali did as Bragi suggested, taking his horn off his belt to have it filled and swigging down a couple of mouthfuls. He could drink no more, beginning to feel sick with the anticipation of what was to come rather than the movement of the ship. The berserks were baying now, screaming obscenities and promises to their god. He glanced over his shoulder again and got the impression of the blue giving way to green behind him. Then white joined the blue and green. A beach. There was a judder, and Vali was thrown back off his chest to sprawl onto the ballast. Propelled by the frenzied rowing, the boat grounded on the beach far harder than it needed to. Vali thought they'd been lucky not to tear out the hull. He had to roll aside as a stampede swept over him, the berserks howling in their mania to get off the boat. Not one bore a shield, none even armor or a helmet, just spears, axes, and in the case of the leader, a sword in one hand and the huge rattle in the other. Vali turned to see who they were charging at, but saw nothing. Just a pleasant, broad beach of light sand, the sunny day, birds over the meadows, and deep green grass. There was no enemy there at all. The berserks were off and running across the island, the more conventional warriors disembarking from the other two boats behind them.
Come on, said Bragi. We've attacked from the rear of the island for surprise. You go ahead of me. I'm too old to run all the way. Remember, pretty women, fit men, they're the slaves you're looking for. The rest, kill 'em for the fear it'll bring next time.
Vali stepped from the boat and had the strange sensation of setting foot on foreign soil for the first time in his life. He was inclined to stop and look around him, to see how the place differed from his home, but he knew he couldn't. He pressed on in the throng of helmeted warriors from the Knars, all of them carrying shields, chasing the fast-moving unarmored berserks inland. The island was flat and not too long, but he could see no buildings on it. They moved quickly, and as they crested a small ridge, found the first bodies, four old men dead in a furrowed field. He could tell they were old by their white hair. Their features gave no clue to their age. The men had been mutilated, their heads cut and cut again, stamped on and kicked. Vali took them for slaves, as they were dressed very plainly, and the two heads that were still anything like intact were shaved completely at the front, the hair left long behind, which he thought must be the sign of the lowest rank, a mark of their subjugation. There were farm implements lying discarded around them, rakes and hoes, but more than could be used by just four. Vali wondered why they hadn't simply sat down and been taken prisoner. Why should a slave fight for his owner? Then he realized what had happened. He thought of the chanting of the men on the boat, and the consumption of those mushrooms, the frenzy of the dash for the shore. There would be no surrendering to the berserks. There were three paths of action available to the people on the island: run, fight, or die. The other slaves had fled, leaving only these old ones behind. Vali shook his head. If the berserks were on a killing rampage, it greatly reduced the chances of them getting anything valuable from the raid. A slave was worth as much as gold in some ways. He ran on, up a long incline. There was some sort of sound. At first he took it for the crying of gulls, but then, as he got nearer, it became easier to identify. Human screaming. It was high-pitched and desperate, counterpointed with low roars of aggression. Smoke was already in the air. There, towards the beach below him, was a settlement of around 15 houses. He was struck that they were the wrong shape. There were a couple of big halls like a king might own, but the huts that surrounded them were all tiny and circular. That was wrong, he thought. Huts should be square, perhaps with bowed sides, but not round. He'd never seen anything like them. He found them very exotic and exciting, and he very much wanted to go inside one to see what it was like. Then there were the people. Vali had rarely seen so many in one place, all men, too, panicking under the axes of the berserks. Only a few were making an effort at resistance, most were running for their lives. He stood watching the attack for some time, watching the huts burn, watching the berserks hack down the men. All the enemy, thought Vali, appeared to be slaves, all with that strange shaved head at the front, the hair long at the rear. Vali couldn't help noticing that none of the berserks had actually bothered to take any plunder. With that in mind, he looked down the hill towards the biggest building, the one with the cross on the roof, which he took for a temple. If anything was to be retrieved, he thought, he had better do it before the whole settlement was reduced to ashes. Bragi had made the top of the hill and put his hand to Vali's shoulder.
"Draw your weapon, Prince," he said.
"I hardly think that's going to be necessary," said Vali. "There's no resistance at all."
"Best to have something in your hand, in case our men of Odin run out of Westmen to spear," he said. "Nothing like the sight of a sword to remind them whose side they're on."
Vali shook his head. He could hardly believe what he was hearing. Still, he unsheathed his sword. It was a good one, a single-edged sayax sent to him by his father, more a very large knife than a true sword, but strong, short, and straight, with a whalebone pommel. He felt embarrassed by it, and wished he had a plainer weapon. Still, he left his shield at the top of the hill. He didn't see any point carrying it, because even from this distant vantage point, he knew he was at more risk fighting with staves with Adisla's brothers than he was here. It was, he thought, instructive what panic could do. Some of the West men had managed to make off down the beach, but others, their wits frightened away by the shock of the raid, had just run into the sea and were attempting to swim for it. Vali didn't fancy their chances. He had a good sailor's eye, and the water between the island and the mainland looked a prime spot for currents. He came down to the big building. It was even taller than he had thought from far away, with long, thin windows cut into overlapping logs. On the ground outside lay the remains of a stone carving that the berserks had smashed. It was a finely wrought cross within a wheel, about 2 handspans across. It was beautiful, thought Vali, and he almost felt like taking it home with him. The berserks were hammering at the door of the temple, unable to get in, screaming and jabbering. From a burning hut, one brought a brand, cursing and muttering as he did.
"Tell him to forget that," said Vali to Bragi.
Bragi gave a little start. He was unused to Vali expressing a view on anything. The boy's manner, thought the bodyguard, was not unlike his father's.
"Put that down," said Bragi.
The berserk took no notice and threw the torch up onto the thatch. Luckily it was high and steep, and the brand tumbled off. Bragi looked at Vali and shrugged. Some of the farmers from Ekund came up. They had caught one of the shaven-headed men and had stripped him naked, booting him towards the temple.
"Tell them to open it," said one.
The man was old and terrified. He just sank to his knees, put his hands together and jabbered.
"Open it, you girl, or I'll cut your throat."
The voice was Hrolefr's, a farmer from up on the hill behind Disa. Vali had thought of him as a gentleman. He often helped Disa take things to market and was skilled at carving. Here he was, though, with the same knife that produced tiny ships, little men, even Vali's own king's table pieces, thrust at the side of a man's neck.
"He can't open it. They'll have secured it from the inside," said Vali.
Hrolefr shrugged and cut the man's throat. A thick spray of blood pulsed into the air, soaking the farmer, and the man fell forward, kicking and squealing on the floor. Hrolefr turned to the other raiders and shouted,
"See me in my battle sweat! See how I spread the slaughter dew among the warriors of the enemy!"
Everyone else laughed and clapped. Vali couldn't believe that he was boasting about what he had done. The man had been old. It was harder, much harder, to stick a pig. Was this what they amounted to, all those tales of glory? Killing old men who were begging for their lives? Vali wanted this to end, and quickly, the quicker to return to the boats. He needed to get into the temple as fast as possible. The prospect of plunder might prevent further pointless murder. The screams were becoming more distant. Everyone on the island who could run had run, and most of the berserks were pursuing them. A brief silence descended over the houses. Vali breathed in. The odor of smoke against the chill of the summer morning was wonderful to him. The roof was too high to reach. The doors were impregnable. If they had long enough, it would be possible to dig under the walls. There was a chance, though, that he could get in at a window. It was too narrow for any of the bigger men, but he was so much smaller.
"Bragi," he said, gesturing with his eyes to the window, "make sure no idiot burns it while I'm inside."
He took off his sword belt and stripped off all 3 tunics he was wearing as armor. Bragi helped him onto his shoulders. Vali could reach the narrow slit of the window, but couldn't gain any proper purchase on it.
"Stand on my head," said Bragi, straightening his helmet.
Vali did so, and managed to get a second hand into the gap and lever himself up. He forced one shoulder in, wriggled and pushed, and finally he was through, dropping onto a table directly beneath him. There were 4 windows in the building, and their light made it easy to see. At first his impression was just color. Silvers and golds, a large embroidery on the wall to his right, the door with its bar to the left. His eyes adjusted, and he saw the men. There were four of them, with shaven heads, two with large candlesticks, one with a weighty silver cross. Only one, a man of his age, 13 or so, was unarmed. It was then that Vali realized he had forgotten his weapon. The men didn't charge him, which he thought stupid, because he would open the door if not knocked down. They just stood shouting at him. He recognized some familiar words in their odd language.
God! Redeemer! Help!
The man with the cross thrust it forward, shook it at him, and said something Vali didn't understand at all.
Hyskiada! 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 Satan!
Then the man said something else he could make out, although the accent was heavy and strange.
Fleeny!
Were they casting a spell on him? Vali didn't feel like he was being enchanted. There was a renewed clamour at the door, and some more snatches of sentences came through.
Burn Odin! Blood Swan! Incitar!
Vali stood up from his crouch. He didn't get off the table, because he wanted to appear tall to emphasize his royal status. There were four men, all of working age, and a reasonable quantity of silver. That wasn't a bad haul. First, though, he had to subdue them unarmed. All he had was words, and he knew only half of those would be understood.
"I think it's you who should have fled," said Vali. "There are wolves and bears outside this door. Shall I feed you to them?"
He dropped off the table, went to the door and made to open it. The men jabbered, but didn't rush him. There was a clang. His sayax had been thrown through the window. Vali looked at the weapon. He made a gesture of refusal towards it.
"No need for that," he said, "if you're sensible. Better a slave than a dead man, I think."
One of the men spoke. Vali understood some of the words.
"Inroad from the sea. The hand of..."
And there was that word again.
"Satan in this."
"Just a good ship and the blessing of the gods," said Vali.
"One God," said the man. "Christ Jesus."
He pointed to the embroidery. Vali looked at it. It was a strange but beautiful representation of Odin suspended from a tree, a spear piercing his side. It was a depiction, he felt, of the god's quest for wisdom at the well of Mimir, where he had given up his eye for knowledge. But if these men were Odin's, where was their fury and their fight? He couldn't imagine walking into a place holy to the berserks and coming away alive.
"He is on our side, not yours," said Vali. "Lay down your weapons and submit. I offer you my protection. On oath."
The one word seemed to get through. Protection. The men looked at each other. Then they put down the heavy silver and sank to their knees, pressing their hands together and muttering. The banging at the door became even louder. He walked up to the men in front of him. One of them held a strange oblong object, like a slab of leather. Vali went to take it from him, but the man held on. Vali wondered what it was that he should cling to it more dearly than silver. He went to the table, where there was another of these slabs. He picked it up and looked at it. It was paler on three sides than it was on the fourth. The pale edges seemed to be pressed together in layers. He went to put it back down, but as he did so, it fell open. Inside were lots of papers, like he'd seen Veles Libor carrying. The squiggly writing was all over them, along with some beautiful pictures. Then Vali saw it. These slaves could teach him to write. They valued these papers, so they must be able to read them.
Lord?
There was a face at the window.
Braggy?
Yes, Lord.
How did you get up there?
A ladder, Lord.
Vali laughed.
You could have saved your head if we'd thought to look. I'm going to open the doors. Make sure no one, and I mean no one, harms the slaves I've taken. They're my property. Can you make those Odin blind idiots understand?
I can try, Lord.
Three knocks when you're ready.
Vali knew the challenge he would face once the doors were open, and so, making gestures of calm, he picked up his sayax and took the old man with the slab of leather by the arm. He was the least useful as a slave, and the most at risk. After a short time, he heard the three knocks and removed the bar. Light flooded the church as the doors opened. Two berserks rushed past him carrying spears and burning brands.
No, said Vali.
But it was too late. Two of the slaves were stabbed and fell. One other, the young man of Vali's age, ran for it, dragging the old man with him.
No killing! Shouted Vali.
Luckily, the men fell into the hands of Bragi and the farmers and were merely smashed to the floor with pommel blows.
Silver!
Shouted Vali. And that was enough. The rest of the men poured into the church. Vali didn't know what to do to save his captives. Acting on instinct, he pushed them both up the hill at sword point, back towards the longship. It occurred to him to let them go, but he was fascinated to learn how to write, and saw it as a key to developing and maintaining his kingdom when he came to rule it. Also, Vali had met very few foreigners before, and was interested to talk to them. These men, he thought, might have something interesting to teach him. As they got back to the top of the hill, he picked up his shield and looked down. Now the church and the little huts were all on fire. Livestock was being rounded up and driven towards them. The men with Vali began to weep. Vali looked at them properly for the first time. They were clearly slaves, he thought, as their rough clothes and shaven heads denoted. Even slaves develop a bond with a place, though. Again he noticed how enchanting the island looked. The sparkle of the sun on the ocean, the thick line of smoke stretching out over the sea to the mainland beyond, like an enchanted causeway, the fires themselves. In the face of such beauty, it was difficult to remember that it was a scene of destruction. He pressed on to the ships, and when he got to them, was the first back apart from five or six guards.
"Good plunder?"
asked one as he arrived. Vali just gestured to the slaves with his sayax. The guard nodded.
"One of them's a bit old, but the other one'll be worth a bit at Kaupangan."
He was talking about the big southern market. Vali had heard of it, but never visited it. These captives weren't going there. He had plans for them.
"They're mine," he said.
The guard shrugged.
"Depending on the split," he said.
"They're mine," said Vali. "I'm the one who made the effort to save them. The others are more interested in easy kills than taking prisoners."
The guard shrugged again and sat down on the shore.
"See what the berserks say," he said.
It was nightfall before everyone returned. Vali sat by the fire and watched as herds of sheep and cows were driven to the ships. There were no slaves. Vali could hardly believe how wasteful the raid had been. All the loot from the church was piled up, along with flagons of wine that didn't remain untouched for long. Some men even came with bales of hay they had stolen, more than would be needed to feed the animals on the short journey back. Vali was thankful that there were pebbles on the beach at home, otherwise he felt sure they'd be returning with a full haul of those, too. The berserks had taken no prisoners, though they had a quantity of coin and some silver plates, along with about 10 slaughtered geese. A change came over these men with the end of the day. They were no longer the baying animals he had seen get off the boat. Instead, they seemed listless, weak even, hardly talking, just crouching by the fires and staring into the flames through red and angry eyes.
Lord?
Yes? It was Bragi's hand on his shoulder.
Did you not hear me? We are to put out to sea. This island is linked to the mainland by a causeway that is open at low tide. We should leave. The burning buildings may have drawn attention to us, and we risk counterattack if we stay here.
Why burn them, then? Said Vali.
What?
If the fires give away our position, then why light them? Surely it would have been better to plunder the place in secrecy.
The berserks will have their fires, said Bragi.
The animals were loaded onto the ships, thrown in, roped in, hauled in, until the vessels were perilously low in the water. Some of the bigger creatures couldn't be fitted in and were slaughtered at the beach and tied behind the ships. They would be dragged back, as long as the ropes didn't break. Vali waited with his slaves to take his place in the drakkar. The helmsman was counting.
No room for these two, he said.
Vali looked at him.
You'll make room. I want them for my slaves.
Lord, it would mean offloading valuable animals.
The boy is sickly, and the man's old and not much good for work.
Vali could, he supposed, just let them go. The raiders would be long gone before they could help any pursuers. Still, he reminded himself of who he was. He'd spent so long at Adisla's hearth among farm children that he sometimes forgot.
Princes need different work to common men.
Lord, I...
There was a scream, and the old man fell to the ground. In the firelight, Vali saw the gleam of a knife and the red eyes of Bodvar Bjarki, the scarred berserk who had attacked him. Then there was a sudden movement, and the boy cried out and fell too.
Debate over, prince, said the berserk.
He could hardly stand. He seemed torpid and sluggish, but had still stabbed both men in an instant. For the first time in Vali's life, he felt genuinely angry, violent even, and as that emotion touched him, he felt a chill go through him. This wasn't the sort of rage that explodes in fury, but an insidious, crawling thing, as present and real as the smell of smoke across a summer meadow. Vali was frightened by the intensity of the feeling. He would, he thought, have his revenge. It came to him not as an intention, but as a fact, as real and unavoidable as the engulfing night, the endless stars, and the cold, dark sea. It was the first time in his life he could remember feeling hatred, and the sensation was almost intoxicating. The raiders were around him, their faces expectant. Vali, though, would not give them what they were asking for, a demand for compensation, a challenge to a duel. Instead, he smiled at the berserk and said, "I will not forget you." Bodvar Bjarki just grunted, huddled into his cloak, and made his way onto the ship. Vali bent to the old man. Dead. Then he went to the boy. He was breathing, but Vali could see he was dreadfully pale and close to death. He held him in his arms to give him comfort. The boy looked up. Vali had expected to see blame or hatred. Instead, he saw something else. Understanding. Sympathy. Pity, even. He found it chilling. The boy looked at Vali and said a word he recognized.
God!
Well, he doesn't seem to have done you much good, does he? Thought Vali, but he said nothing. In a few moments, the boy had stopped breathing. Vali climbed aboard a knarr. He had no intention of spending the journey home with the berserks. He took an oar without a word, listening to the men around him swapping stories of the raid. Farmer Hrolifr told how he had faced the enemy's leader and cut him to the floor. He omitted to say that the man was naked, kneeling and begging for his life at the time. Others told tales of taking on two or three enemies at once, leaving out inconvenient facts such as that their opponents had been unarmed. The most remarkable thing about the stories of the returning warriors was that they seemed to believe them themselves. He looked over to the Drakkar as the ships pulled away from the beach. The one Westman the Berserks had saved had been hanged, sacrificed to Odin in thanks for their safe return. As Vali watched the man dangling from the mast, his legs kicking as if in a useless attempt to run away, he made up his mind that he would never seek that god's help. His followers, he thought, dishonored him.
"I hate you, Odin," he said, "and I will oppose you in all your works."
For some reason that made him feel better, and he bent his back to the oar, losing himself in the rhythm of the rowing, thought banished by effort. Chapter 9. Varieties of Darkness. Some grow in light, and others in darkness. Felig, the boy the witches had taken, was not raised on the sunlit coast, but on the mountaintops, with the wild men and the wolves. The witch queen sensed that the boy she had taken needed to be prepared in a different sort of magic to the one she practiced. Her magic was known by the ordinary people as Seid. It was a wholly female art, a magic of the mind. Gulveig had blurred the division between past and future. She had travelled, entranced, as the shadow of a hare or a wolf to enter the nightmare of a dozing king, but the arts of physical magic were unknown to her. Her trances and meditations would leave her weak for days afterwards, near to death even, and the toll on her was enormous. Her limbs were wasted, and her body emaciated. She seemed no more than a rune herself, an arrangement of lines rather than a human figure. As the years went by, the change that other girls knew did not come to her. It would never come. The witch queen accepted the cost of her knowledge was that she would remain in a child's body her whole life, small, weak, and undeveloped. The werewolf could not follow that path. Odin, she knew, would come as a warrior, dispensing death at the end of his spear. Her protector couldn't be weak, so Gulveig could only do part of what was needed. To create her werewolf, his body would need to be strengthened and conditioned by the berserks, the Ulfhednar, who lived as wolves and fought as wolves, gaining unnatural strength and ferocity from their training and their magic. The witch spoke to a berserker chieftain in a dream, and the man took the baby, along with a payment of medicines, from a boy servant at the bottom of the troll wall. Until Felig was 7, he lived on the lowest slopes of the mountains with a small berserker clan, who cared for him, fed him, taught him trance dances, and beat him. On his 7th birthday, the berserk chieftain who had taken him from the wall woke him before dawn, and led him back up into the mountains. It was early winter, and the going was hard. The berserk took him over the snowfields, waiting for him when he fell, driving him on when he tired, shouting when he tried to use his little spear as a staff, warning him not to abuse something on which his life could depend. Most of the way the snow was shallow, and they didn't need their snowshoes, but as they got higher it deepened, and they had to stop to tie them on. They climbed up through stark lines of spruce and pine that towered out of the fields of white like an army of giants, until the trees began to lose their fight with the altitude and grow smaller and thinner, eventually shrinking to the size of shrubs. In a small valley next to a waterfall turning to ice, the berserk stopped.
"I am to leave you here," he said.
The berserk was a rough man, but even he gave a sad smile.
"Take care, little Felig. We will miss you. You have enough to eat to last you until tomorrow. You know how to climb a tree with your rope, and remember, the wolves will not want to risk injury. If they come,
Attack them, and make them look for something weaker.
The child said nothing, but as the berserk turned down the slope, he followed him.
You are to stay here, said the man. Your time with us is over.
He turned to go once more, but the child followed him again. The berserk, though rough and given to beating him, was the only father he'd known, his wife his only mother. He wanted to go back to the cooking pot and his brothers and sisters, to help his father at his forge and lie next to his mother in the cold nights, warm and protected.
You stay, said the berserk.
He didn't have to say what would come next. He'd already asked once more than he normally would. There would be no third request, just the lash of his belt. Felek felt frightened and very alone. He clutched his spear and said,
One day I will come back and kill you.
The berserk smiled.
It truly is a shame to lose you, Felek. I believe you will. When you are a man, you'll be a great warrior, and I'll be old, should I live so long. It will be an honor to die by your hand. Don't be frightened. Your destiny is already woven, and it doesn't end today.
He turned again down the slope, and in moments he was gone. Felek looked about him through the slit in the cloth he had tied around his face to shield his eyes from the glare. It had begun to snow lightly. Above him was a ridge, below him the valley. He saw the footprints that had brought them there, but he had hunted for long enough to know that the snow would have already obscured the rest of the way home. He didn't know what to do, so he just stood wondering why he had been brought to such a desolate place, and what he had done to offend the people he considered his family. Presently his feet began to feel cold, and he decided it would be good to find shelter. The days were short, and already the sun was low in the sky. Felek had never been treated as a child, and so had never thought as a child. He had hunted almost from when he could walk, and had been expected to sharpen weapons, cook food, make fires, and clean himself from the moment he had been able to understand what to do. Raised to self-reliance, he came up with a plan. He would do what his father did when caught by a blizzard: dig a pit beneath a tree, build a platform of branches within the pit, and sleep there. The next day he would head down and see if he could find someone who would take him, maybe even sneak home and tell his mother he was sorry and beg to be taken back. He went back down the slope and found a suitable tree near a small cliff that he thought would provide wind protection. He had been scraping away with a rock for about half an hour when he heard the howling. A single wolf, somewhere above the trees, towards the sinking sun, he thought, but it was difficult to tell in the mountains. He checked his spear was near and carried on digging. An answering call came from down the valley. He carried on digging. A third call, this time closer. He looked up to see a large white wolf, much bigger than he was, sitting on the ridge above him. The animal was just visible against a large rock. A heartbeat later it had moved, vanishing into the snow. Felek kept digging. Life with the berserks had taught him never to think too much on consequences. He needed a shelter. It was getting late. He had to dig. If the wolves came for him, he would die. If he was outside without a shelter, he would die. Climb the tree and die. So dig and hope the wolves do not come. But they did come, soundlessly assembling on the ridge. The howls had been to locate each other. There was now no need for any more noise, no need to alert rival packs. As the weak sun dipped behind the ridge and the dusk turned the sky to a mettled purple, 8 wolves watched the digging boy. As soon as the first one moved, Felek grabbed his spear and gave a shout. The largest wolf was darker than the first he had seen. It had dirty red and grey fur, was as tall as the child at the shoulder, and looked much heavier. It halted halfway down the slope at Faleg's cry. The berserk had been right. Wolves in the wild are scavengers first, killers second, and fighters only as a last resort. In the snowy woods, getting injured means limited mobility, which means starvation and death. Like all animals, humans included, wolves prefer their prey weak, preferably defenceless. Faleg fixed the animal with a stare and forwarded his spear. The light was dropping and flattening the perspective. His vision swam, and he fought to maintain concentration on what was in front of him. From the corner of his eye, he saw a wolf insinuating its way around to his right. A glance to his left confirmed the same was happening on the other side. Faleg wasn't scared.
"I am deserted and ready to die," he shouted. "Which one of you, my lords of the forest, wants to do the same? When I am in Odin's halls and you are at his feet, how I shall kick you!"
One of the wolves was behind him now, he could sense, and more were filing left and right. Still he fixed the dirty red-grey wolf with his spear. That was the biggest, and would die, which would make a good tale at the feast table in the All-Father's halls. The big wolf ambled towards him through the floating light. For the first time, Faleg felt fear rise in him. There was something strange about its movements, something wrong. The other wolves had seemed to glide on the snow. This one, he could see, was very powerful, but more uncomfortable in its gait. Was it injured? The dusk was falling, vision difficult. What was wrong with it? It was huge. What he had thought was merely a large animal, he could now see was of truly terrifying proportions. It was as big as a man, bigger. His father was the biggest man he had seen, but this creature was taller by a head. 10 paces away, the wolf stopped and looked at the boy through the greying dusk. Faleg, who had been raised to regard his life as a trifle, to believe that the noblest destiny lay in death in battle, who coveted that fate like others might covet gold or a fine house, began to tremble. This wasn't an ordinary wolf, he was sure, but a creature of myth. The animal lowered its head to the snow. "Kin," said the wolf. The word seemed to judder into Faleg's mind. He looked into the creature's eyes. Then he realized. It was a man peering out from under a wolf's skin. He was huge and powerful, and awfully weather-beaten, with frost in his blonde beard. He had no fur on his arms and legs, just a long reindeer coat of the sort you could see on any winter hunter, though he carried no bow or spear, and wore no snowshoes or skis. Suddenly, all the fear that Faleg had been holding in flooded over him, and he felt terribly cold. The night seemed to collapse upon him, and the stars awoke like the eyes of a million wolves, all hungry for his blood.
"Help me," said Faleg, unable to stop his tears.
The man said nothing, as he would never say anything again, but turned and walked up the slope. The boy followed him, with the pack trailing behind. The berserk had done as the witches had asked, given the child over to Kveld Ulf, the evening wolf, the shapeshifter of the hills. He was not a werewolf, as Faleg would later come to understand it, but a man who had become, by instinct and thought, half-animal. The boy grew up as much in the dark as in the light. This was not the solid tomb-dark of the witches, but the northern dark that bristles with stars and is shot with stripes of light, where morning brings mirages of cities floating in the distance, and evening falls under a wide silence. There was no fire, just a cave den and the bodies of the pack close about him. He would warm his hands by plunging them into the carcass of a reindeer the pack had taken, use the moon for light, and learn to love the taste of uncooked meat. In the short days of winter, he fed well. Animals were weak and easy to catch. Summer was the spirit time, perpetually light, and the pickings more scarce. Feleg would push on in fruitless hunts, hardly sleeping, never speaking, his thoughts freeing themselves from the anchor of language in years of silence, his mind ever more animal, his body ever tougher. In the weak dark of the summer night, Kveld Ulf would beat his drum and sing discordant chants. They would cut out the bladders of reindeer that had eaten strange mushrooms and drink the piss, and the boy would be transported to the spirit kingdoms, where he ran through dark passageways and dripping caves, drank from subterranean streams, and felt the darkness of the underground world widen his mind. He had a sense, as powerful as the smell of reindeer musk, of something alive in those tunnels. The caves, he thought, were hungry. When he came back to himself, it seemed his body could feed on the dreams, making him unnaturally strong and fast. By the age of 12, he could kill a reindeer with only his hands, his spear having long since broken, and Kveld Ulf refusing to allow him another. At 14, he began raiding, but not as Vali did. His prey were travellers through the land, merchants heading north with goods for the whale people, or the king's men travelling south on sleds and skis with tribute taken from them. He and Kveld Ulf stole from them as they slept, and attacked them if they woke to challenge them, tearing flesh with their teeth and nails, breaking limbs and snapping necks, dashing swords to the floor and pulling spears from hands. He still understood the cries of the men in the camps, but their real meaning of fear, anguish, longing for loved ones, was becoming lost to him. They kept the plunder in their dens high in the mountains. It meant nothing to Feleg. You couldn't eat it, and it wouldn't keep you warm. But Kveld Ulf knew that the fine walrus ivory combs, the gold arm rings and good swords, would one day be useful to the boy. He would be going back to the witches, and it would not hurt to have some gifts for the witch queen. Kveld Ulf knew from his own dealings with the witches that a gift of some sort could distract the sisters long enough for them to remember that he wasn't an intruder, and they had in fact sent for him. By the age of 15, Feleg saw as a wolf and thought as a wolf, his body hard, his teeth a weapon. The mountain winds tearing through his mind, pastless and futureless, he lived caught in the moment, with no more thought than a snowflake on the breeze. That summer the hunting was thin, and he found himself down in the foothills, ghosting around the farmsteads to try to take a duck or a pig. He was wary of being discovered because the farms were a tight network. One blow on a horn could very quickly bring 20 or 30 armed men. That was when he had come to the ruin. It was a small longhouse, the roof broken in by the weather. It was raining, and he decided to seek shelter there. He went inside. Scavengers, animal and human, had taken everything of value, but there were some signs of the former occupants. A broken distaff on the floor, a worn-out shoe, even a small rickety stool. There was better shelter at the back of the house, but he decided to stay near the centre, next to where the smoke vent would have been. He didn't know why, but instinct made him pick up the stool and sit on it, something he hadn't done in nearly 10 years. And then he saw them in his mind. His sisters by the fire, his father, massive and silent on the bench at the back of the room, drinking, his mother patching clothes. It was his house, where he had lived until he was 7. He hadn't known what to make of the feelings the memories stirred inside him, and he had gone out into the rain. He had never returned. At 16, he awoke in the dusk of the cave mouth and stood up ready to hunt. Kveld Ulf tapped him on the chest and let him know with his eyes that today would be different. He led him across two valleys to where the pack's oldest wolf had fallen down a gully and lay dying at the bottom. The men descended to sit beside it. The wolf's eyes were cloudy, and its breath shallow. Kveldulf looked at Feleg, and Feleg understood that the wolf's spirit was to join with his own. For 2 days the men sat and chanted, beat the drum and shook their rattles. On the third day the wolves came and added their voices to the music. They sat in the galleries of frost and howled out a strange chorus of exultation and lament. Feleg, his head buzzing with tiredness and the noise, took the creature's head in his lap and stroked its ears as it died. His body trembled, and there was a taste of blood in his mouth. Strange longings coursed through him, and where the world had seemed wide beneath the stars, now it narrowed to a thin stream of hunger raging through his mind. He stripped the skin from his fallen brother with a sharp stone, tore out his entrails, ate his heart and liver. Then he placed the bloody pelt around him, looking out from behind the wolf's face, as the wolf had done, as the wolf. After that, Feleg had no story, no progression of events from day to day. He hunted, and he fed, and he slept, and he sat howling beneath the stars. He was part of nature, moving beneath the wind and the sun, as heedless of his identity as the foam upon the surf. And then, at midsummer, when the sun never dipped beyond the suggestion of dusk, his double came, and his life changed again, and forever. Chapter 10. The Dead God's Bride.
What did you say?
Vali turned to face the person who had spoken. It was Ageir, one of Forkbeard's sworn bodyguard, a man of around 19, 2 years older than Vali, though not much taller. It was over 3 years since the raid, 3 years in which Vali had gone no further than half a day's travel from the farms. He had asked Forkbeard to let him go trading, asked him even to allow him to command his own raids. But the king was adamant. Vali would go and fight as a common warrior or not travel at all, so Vali did not go. There were many reasons for his refusal. One was that he would not take part in needless slaughter when there were so many easier ways of extracting loot. He had calculated the profit that had been thrown away on the raid on what he now knew was a monastery, and had concluded that the price of the slaves he had lost to Bodvar Bjarki's brutality alone could have bought him 10 head of cattle, before he even started considering how many possible captives had gone free because the berserks hadn't bothered to surround the island. Another reason for his reluctance was that he thought his people had things to learn from the West men. One of their priests, the men with the shaven heads, had visited Ekund when Vali was 15. To Vali's disappointment, Forkbeard had refused to even let him tell his stories. When the man showed him his writing and pointed out how useful it would be in the administration of his kingdom, Forkbeard had torn it up in front of him and told him to go while he still had his life. It had been the talk of the village. Vali had learned the man was a member of the cannibalistic religion of Christ, whose followers ate flesh and drank blood. The main reason he kept away from war, though, hardly acknowledged to himself, was that he wanted to be branded sword-shy. He hoped Forkbeard would not let his daughter marry such a man, which would leave him free to marry Adisla. But so far the king had refused to release him from his obligation. Vali had also got a merchant to carry a message to his father telling him point-blank that he would not marry the girl. But there would be no reply. Vali took it as a rebuke and felt foolish. His father could hold him to his duty if he chose. His protestations and refusals were meaningless. He had to accept he was a prince, but, until he was forced to confront the fact and marry Ragnar, he would indulge the fantasy that he was a farmer, a free man, as they were called. He gave Adisla's little brother Manni his seax, and only attended training with Bragi to allow the old man to retain his self-respect. Without a valued task, he knew Bragi would wither. Out of gratitude for the kindness Bragi had shown him in guiding him through the raid, he tried hard, too. When he was beating Bragi's shield with the stave that stood in for a sword, he let the injustice of his inability to marry Adisla fuel his aggression. For the rest of the time, he helped Adisla and her mother around their farm or worked the flocks with her brothers and spent his evenings chatting in Danish with Barth. He would not go raiding, though. That took all his courage. He knew that the gods hate nothing more than a coward, and only the knowledge that he was acting for the right reasons allowed him to keep up the pretense that he was. The king didn't call Vali a coward to his face, but there were plenty in his bodyguard who murmured the word as the prince passed. Ageir was one of them. Vali would have preferred to take the insults, looking on them as helping him on the path that he wanted to travel, but he wasn't made like that, and always reacted.
"I said, what did you say?"
"Nothing, prince. Nothing at all."
Vali had heard the word, but he didn't want to press Ageir to repeat it. If he did, Vali would be forced to challenge him to a duel. Ageir was no keener. He wanted the fun of taunting Vali, but didn't want to push it to a fight. Vali was still Orthon's son, and so valuable to King Forkbeard. The penalty for killing the prince in a legal contest or not would be severe. And, besides, he had seen the way the prince split those staves against Bragi's helmet. He didn't want to find out what he could do with a sword. Vali grunted and turned away.
"Are you, looking forward to the wedding? We'll have a rare feast that night, I think,"
Ageir said as he did so.
"What wedding?"
"Adisla, the slut from the top forms, is to marry Drengi half-troll from over the valley. What a union that will be!"
Vali was stunned. He even forgot the insult to Adisla.
"That is not so," he said.
"I'm afraid that it is," said Ageir. "I heard it from her brother this morning. Go and ask if you don't believe me."
"If you're lying, you'll answer to me," said Vali. Then he ran.
He knew that Drengi had asked Adisla to marry him before and been refused. Drengi was a good man, strong and hard-working, but he was known as half-troll because he was both ugly and not much given to talk. Adisla, thought Vali, could never agree to marry him, could she? He made Disa's house at a sprint. Adisla wasn't there when he arrived, but her mother was sitting outside in the sunlight, pulverizing some acorns from her store with a large stone.
"Is it true?"
He saw by her eyes that it was.
"Why?"
Disa stopped her pounding.
"You are of a different rank, Vali, and sworn to a princess. My girl is 3 summers past the age she could have married. It's right that she should do so."
"I love her, Ma. Is it right she should turn her back on that?"
Disa tapped the pounding stone on the edge of her wooden bowl.
"She hasn't said yes to him yet, though I think she intends to. Don't let her. Make her refuse him."
She pursed her lips.
"What life would it be as your concubine, Vali? You can't marry her, so that's all she could ever be. What if you tire of her?"
"I will not tire of her. Won't you? Forkbeard changes his concubines with every season. I'm not Forkbeard," he said.
Vali wanted to say more, to reason with Disa, but he was too shocked. He had never discussed it with Adisla, but had always assumed he would have to marry Forkbeard's daughter if that's what their peoples demanded. Then he would father a son and never have much to do with her again. taking Adisla as his wife in all but name. Once Adisla was married to another man, it became a different proposition. That brought spears, blood, and feuds. Vali